Well, I guess can we get started since they closed the door and we are the in crowd, the cool guys that can be in this session. So, welcome. I'm Tobias Turnström, and I'm a lead program manager in the SQL Server and Windows Azure SQL Database group. My team, we own the connectivity into the engine, so that's the ODBC driver for Linux, Node.js, we just released preview of PHP drivers, ADO.NET, so SQL client, JDBC, and OLIDB. And then we also own the T-SQL language, so the language itself, type system, libraries, things like this. And so this talk, we're going to look into what we added in SQL Server 2012 and a bit about what you should think about consuming these things. So like always, what we release, a feature is a tool, right? And it can be used for certain things, and it's good for certain things and not good for certain things. It's always my favorite when you release a feature and you go, oh, like XML data type is a good example. Why did Microsoft add XML data type? Then I'll just, you know, I'll have one column with one row and it will be all XML. No, that's not the thought. So we'll look a bit into what we added and try to kind of weigh things against each other. So we'll talk about these scenarios. So one is key generation. So how do I get unique keys to put into my tables? Exception handling, messages, calculations and aggregations. And then we have a bucket of what we call common tasks. Right? Things that you frequently do that would be good to help some more helpful tools to do them. And feel free to ask questions during the talk, as long as they are simple questions, no hard ones. And if you ask them at the end, I will be all confused and it will be hard for me to answer. So starting with key generation. So obviously the use case is very clear, right? I need to adhere to this first normal form. I need to be able to uniquely identify my rows. And we have a bunch of ways to do this in SQL Server, right? First of all, we have the primary key, which is the constraint itself, right? That guarantees you that the values are actually unique. And then we have a few different tools to generate keys, such as identity, new ID to generate a GUID, or new sequential ID to generate a somewhat sequential GUID. And also sequence generators that we added to 2012. And there are two sub use cases here which can be more complex than the typical one. One is I want my keys to actually be unique across tables, right? So you could imagine you want your customers table and your employees table to have unique keys across them. So I know I won't have an employee with the same ID as a customer. So these can be very helpful depending on the scenario. The other one is I want to import data. So in a data warehousing scenario, right, you have a bunch of files or you have some other system that has data and you want to import this into your system. As long as it's a single entity, that's typically not a problem. Just you take whatever you have and you shove it into a table, right? It gets more complex when there are relationships between them, right? So I want to import, invoices with invoice rows or something like this. Then if you use an identity on your side, now you have to make sure that the identity you generate for the invoice connects to the invoice ID or opposite, right? And that can be somewhat of a problem. So the options you typically have in these two use cases that are related, right, is generate GUIDs, and just for sake of argument, so everyone is on the same page, this is a GUID, right? The good thing with this is that there is a Windows API, and most platforms have an API to generate one of these. It's an integer that's 128 bits long. This is just the way we display it. And it's guaranteed to be globally unique, right? So I know if I generate it, wherever I generate it, the algorithm is such that I can always know that it will be unique in the table wherever I put it. And this is the... Okay. No touching. Okay. So this is the beauty of the grid, right? I can generate it on the client side, and I know it will work. The problem with it, and we have a summary slide as well coming up, is that it's completely random, right? So this means that you'll get fragmentation if you have an index created on this, which you typically have if it's a key. The other option we have is to create a table to manage the keys. So I have my keys table, right, and I'll have a column called order ID, and that's from this column I will generate the order IDs. Problem here, you can imagine, is serialization of tasks, right, since we will have locking going on. And then we added sequence generators. So what are these sequence generators? It's an object, just like a table or anything, schema-level object, that you can create, and it's basically the identity property. We grab it, rip it out of the table, and make it its own object. It's part of the ANSI standard, and it just generates a range of keys, right? And you can see it's like a state machine. You define what is the starting point of the sequence, what is the increment or decrement. You can go, you know, ascending or descending. Mean value, max value, so you define the domain. Whether or not it should cycle. Cycling, you can imagine, seems stupid if it's a key, right? You don't want to get duplicates. But you can also use this to partition your data, and then it can be practical, right? Create a sequence that goes from 1 to 10 and just cycles around so that you round-robin distribution of your data. And then we have a cache setting here, and the cache setting is somewhat important. So the way identity works in previous versions of SQL Server is that... So the problem is, what is the worst thing that you can imagine this guy doing as well as an identity? Well, the worst thing is obviously generating duplicate keys. That would be, what we refer to as bad. And then you guys would be angry at us. So how do we verify this in the identity case? Well, in the identity case, it always happens on an insert, right? So whenever we start up the database, we can go through the transaction log and check for each table what was the last identity value generated. And then we can easily say, okay, this will be the next one. For sequences, that's not the case, because if we do a simple thing here, create sequence S1. Right? I don't do an insert now. Oh, we changed the shortcut keys. So you can see, I'm not doing any inserts. So obviously, this is not ending up in the transaction log, right? So this means if we want to have consistency here, we have to make sure that whenever we call this next value, we'd have to write something to a permanent table to make sure that we don't generate duplicates in case of a loss of power or something like this. But that would obviously be bad for performance, right? As disks, as we all know, are very slow. Even SSDs are slow, right, in this case, compared to memory. So what we do is we generate a new value every so often, right? And that is the cache size. And I think our default cache size, if I'm not mistaken, is 50. This means that when I now call this function, right, first we grabbed the 50 values, and then we just wrote to a table, say, to a metadata table saying, hey, 51 is the next value, or, you know, 9 billions, whatever that is the next value. And then, obviously, if your server loses power, for example, and you start up, you may have a gap, right, in your sequence. You may have a gap in identity as well if you do rollbacks and things like this. So it's a good thing to think about. This is not good for things like invoice numbers or similar. So the cache size of 50 is not optimal for a very high performance workload. We actually, what we did as a reference is we tried to get the lowest value, so you would get the smallest holes, with similar performance to identity in 2008 or two. That was kind of our measure stick. So if you have a high transaction throughput system, you may want to do alter or create your sequence and set the cache size to something larger. We have customers in TAP program that did something like 200,000 of cache value. And then you can get very, very good performance. And the cache is also, this option is not part of the standard. It's like indexes are not part of the standard either. It's also a bit interesting. This function is, it's the first time we're doing one of these functions publicly. So what is weird with this function that no other functions in SQL do? Well, it changes database state, right? After I execute this function, the state of the database is not the same because I incremented the state machine. So I can use this in, let's just do a simple query here, sales order detail. I can use it in this query, right? What happens if I would do something like this? Where next value 4 is greater than 1? Now it gets tricky. How many times are this being executed now, right? And then you start adding some more predicates and or put it in the join clause or in a subquery or things like this. So this would mean your sequence could be at 1, right? And you ran your query, and then after your query, your query returns 2 rows, and now your sequence is at 2.5 million, right? Because we incremented it every iteration. So we don't allow this, and that's also according to the standard. So you can only run the next value 4 function in whatever context we can guarantee that the number of values used is equal to the number of rows returned. So we can go ahead here and alter the sequence. We start with 1. So by default, you saw it began at the first value of the type. And you can see here that this fails because of, I put next value 4 in the where clause. This is another peculiarity that you can deduce from my previous statement, right? It's a per row constant. This is also according to the standard. And this is so you can do things like have it inside an expression, right? If you imagine doing next value 4 plus 1 times next value 4, it's odd, you know, which... And also in which order are they evaluated and things like this. So SQL is this all-at-once language, which also brings peculiarities. The other thing we did was adding spsequence getRange, which is extremely useful for this scenario I mentioned where you have another system or a bunch of files that you need to import, right? Then obviously you wouldn't want to call the next value 4 function for every row that you want to prep in the text file. The nice thing, right, is that you could, what you would like to do is prep the text file ahead of time with the appropriate IDs and you know, correlate your invoice items to your invoices. Then everything is ready to go, and then you just import the files directly into the table and you'll have very good performance and accuracy and whatnot. But obviously if you call this next value 4 function, you'll have to call it for every row. Right, and it's not a serialized execution, meaning if I do 2 select next value 4s at the same time that generates, you know, 1,000 values each, they will be intermixed. This will not be a continuous range each, right? So if you try to do this would obviously be a performance penalty for you. So that's why we have spgetRange or spsequenceGetRange. You call it and you say, for this sequence, please give me 1,000 values, and we will return in an output parameter or output parameters. This is the first value of the range, the last value, this is how many times we cycled, things like this. And I have I'm not going to run it, but here we have a simple example of how to call it, right, from SQL clients, C#. So I'm saying I want to call spsequence get range. This is the sequence I want to use. I want to grab 10 values, and then I specify the range. First value is the output, is an output parameter, and last value is output parameter, right? And you can see we return SQL variant here, and that is not because we are masochists or anything, right? It's just the way the type system works. So we support all integer types from tiny int up to decimal 38.0. So that's why we have to return a variant. So you'll have to cast it into whatever type you're actually using. So you can see once I execute the query, I'll grab the last value or the first value and last value here, and now I can use it. Oh, what? Ah, so the question from the gentleman who has been thinking a bit about this is, hey, it's not enough to just give me the first and last value, right? If I want to create a state machine on the client side and calculate this, that doesn't help, right? You have to know what was the increment, what was the first, mean value of the sequence, max value of the sequence, does the sequence cycle or not? So this, the SP sequence get range returns all of the parameters for the sequence. So you don't need to do any additional calls. We return everything. It's just I was being lazy, and you caught me. So obviously this, if it could come up again. So obviously this code that I wrote is wouldn't work for all sequences, right? Should we switch to VGA instead? Or? Uh-huh. Let's continue while poke around. So this is just a recap of these pros and cons. So if you look at GUIDs first, they're great because can be generated on the client side without any calls to the server. That's really nice feature, right? That's why a lot of people use GUIDs. They can be made sequential, right? But there are caveats I'll mention. And a very nice property is you cannot guess them, right? Because it's 128-bit random value, more or less, right? It's very good to use in things like URLs, so you can't guess the next value. It's on the con side, it's large, right? 16 bytes, so 128 bits. That's not really good, for example, for a data warehouse, right? If you want to have as efficient processing as possible, you obviously want to stay away from GUIDs. If you went to the column store talk yesterday, you would have heard about the restrictions of data types there. So that's another reason why you would want to stay away from GUIDs. Also, many systems don't support GUIDs. So obviously the easiest thing if you want to read something from another system is just grab the IDs from that system, right? But most systems, or many older systems, obviously don't support GUIDs. You'd have to use a string or something like that to represent it. Causes fragmentation because they're random. You have this sequence, the sequential generation through the new sequential ID function. The problem here is, so we use a Windows API to generate the sequential GUIDs. The problem with this is, as soon as you restart the Windows machine, you'll get a new range, right? So it's not guaranteed to be the same range every time. And that's an issue. And obviously, it's based off of the network card of the MAC address. So if you go and switch machine, for example, for your database, you'll get a new range. So that's another reason why it's not really sequential. And the property of being sequential, that's interesting from a fragmentation standpoint, right? If I always insert at the end, I will get less fragmentation. Separate tables, so this just create that table and keep your IDs in the table and increment the column containing the ID manually, right? So one nice feature is obviously you can do it with any data type and kind of any of your own algorithms to generate the keys, which is practical. You can guarantee continuous ranges because you have locking on the table, right? And also, it does serialize access to this table to get the IDs, which can be a good property, right? Serializing is a bad property from performance standpoint, but it's a good property if you're, for example, interested in a continuous range of numbers, such as for invoice numbers. Then you would want to use something like this. On the downside, the performance, right? It's serialized access, so all transactions that want to generate numbers, they'll have to wait for the previous one to finish. And also, it's not native RDBMS functionality, so this means it's more code, right? You'll have to write it yourself, and whenever you write more code, that is, risk for more defects. On the sequence side, it's great because it supports all integer types, you're not constrained to have it on a single table, right? Just create the sequence. You can use it from default constraints, for example. So I can create one sequence and have five tables that all default next value for Tobias sequence, right? So that means that I will now have unique values across these five tables. Supports range generation, as we saw. And you have this caching knob to basically tune for performance. On the downside, we cannot guarantee a continuous range, right? Because access is not serialized. And you can get holes because of the caching, right? We have a customer that ran in the TAP program that's, I'm not allowed to say who they are, but there's an extremely high performance throughput system. And it was interesting. So you know how we like the inserts to happen at the end of the table because of fragmentation. There is also reasons why you don't want this. So being into databases is kind of like being a politician. It's always like, you know, you have to weigh things back and forth. So when you're after the mega performance, right, if you have the inserts always happening at the end of the table, you'll get a hotspot there, right? So just from memory standpoint, whenever you want to access these pages, it will be very hot and there will be serialized access at some point to this page, right? So what they did, which is very interesting if you have these extreme performance requirements, is if I generate these values, I get integers back, right? They just flipped all of the bits of the integer, right? So they just ran a function, flip all bits, every other call to the function. This means that every other value will be negative, right? Every call to the function. Every other value will be negative, which means that they will end up in different parts of the index. So they did that after using the caching knob. They did that to get kind of squeeze the last bit of performance out of this. So exceptions and messages. So there is a bunch of reasons why you want to use exceptions and messages. So obviously an exceptional thing happened, right? You want to throw an exception. The other would be send status updates to the client, right? My stored procedure is running and it takes hours and you want to, you know, somehow send progress updates to the client so that the client could update UI or something so that the customer end user will know where it's at. Log events, so log where this happened, that happened, so on. And the options that we have is the old, good old raise roar statement. You can notice that it's missing an E in the middle. So that's why it's not raise error, it's raise roar. XP log event, which is an extended procedure, just to write to the event log and error log. You should stay away from using this one, especially if you're interested in going and trying out or using Windows Azure SQL database, because in the cloud, we don't allow you to use extended stored procedures. We don't allow you to write to the event log, right? So there will be another mechanism for logging there. A logging table, right? Just create your own table and insert into that table. The problem with a logging table that's worth just thinking about is obviously all inserts into that table are transactional as well, right? So if you're in a transaction and are inserting into your log table every once in a while and then roll back at the end, obviously your log records will be removed as well. We were hoping to get autonomous transactions into SQL Server 2012. That's basically the ability to say in the middle of wherever in a batch, right, say, I would like now to exit this transaction, do something on the side in its own transaction, and then go back, right? And then you could do this thing for log records, right? You could start an autonomous transaction, insert, go back, and then if you roll back, they're two separate transactions, so you won't roll back the log records. Unfortunately, this didn't make it into 2012, so we're hoping we'll get this into the next release. And then, finally, the throw statement, which is new in 2012. And this one takes a bit of a demo just to show why we added it. The first thing you'll see is that we spelled it correctly, right? It's THROW. This was a big deal. I like to say this about raise roar. This is IntelliSense of the 80s,
right? You skip a few characters and then it gets shorter.
This is Swedish humor.
This is very good. So, raise roar. It takes a bunch of parameters. So I'll say error. And then I have apparently two integers here. And then I'll say print hello. And print is just another form of raise roar. If I execute both of these, what will I get back? Will I get both error or error and hello?
Both, okay. Yes, got both back.
Okay, so this immediately means this raise roar guy is odd, right? It clearly doesn't throw an exception because it didn't stop executing and wandered back the call stack looking for a catch block. What if I increase this to 16? That sounds really...
We'll try?
No, it continued. But the arrow became red. So clearly this first integer, this is the color setting, right? So 16 is apparently red, 10 is black, who knows? 17 blue. Okay, so we apparently changed the color with this one. What if we put this, but it still continued execution, right? What if we put this in a try block? And I'll change it back to 10 first.
So now you can notice it clearly didn't go to the catch block, right? Because it prints both error and hello.
And if I make this 11,
then it seems that it jumped to the catch block, right? Because I didn't get to see the error or hello.
So, okay, this integer is a bit of a weird guy. Now, this is just odd. Now, so granted, T-SQL, old language, right? So we reserve the right to have the oddities. Because the biggest feature we ship is backwards compatibility, right? We don't break you guys. So this, okay, fine. 11 seems to jump to the catch block. 10 doesn't. What happens if you do something like this instead? I'll go ahead and create a procedure that does this.
Okay.
So this procedure has been there for years. It's working nicely, right? And then someone comes and says, hey, let's call this procedure from the try block.
And now it jumped on raise roar into the catch block.
This is a bit scary because this means that the control flow is now dependent on which context your batch is executing in, right? And you definitely want to stay away from this. So this is why we added this throw statement. So throw is very simple. I say throw. Let's just try it. First, which number to throw? And this is actually a nice feature. With raise roar, some of you may have used it, and you want to use error numbers, right? Why would you like to use error numbers? Well, it's a nice thing to map on the client side. Ah, it's 50,063, then I know this happened. If you want to use those with raise roar, you have to add them to the master database first. So SP add message, SP alter message, and so on. With throw, we don't reference the master database at all. So you can just type in whatever number you want, 50,000 and above, so non-system errors, and we'll just throw that. And then you'll notice I only have the last integer. I don't have this severity level that it's called. So this integer is state. It's basically an integer that you can map to an enum or something on the client side. It doesn't do anything on the server side. But if I execute this, you'll notice it never went to print. So this is the magic of throw, right? It just throws. It doesn't do any other stuff. Because raise roar can do lots of stuff. So first of all, it seems that it can throw if you're in a try block, right? The other thing that's interesting with raise roar, that's actually a good use of it, is this guy, with no wait. So with no wait means that we will empty the network buffer, right? So if you have this stored procedure that runs for an hour and you want to send updates to the client somewhere in this batch, right? If you just do raise roar or print, what we do is we'll send it to our network buffer, but if the buffer isn't full, it's not efficient to send it over the network, right? So we'll wait until either the statement completes or we fill up the buffer. So if you do raise roar with no wait, that tells the server, just please empty the network buffer and send now. So that is a useful part of this. And obviously this is not, we didn't add this to throw, right? You also have with log in raise roar, which is basically please write this also to the event log and error log. The other thing that's very nice with throw is, let's add another statement here, master to disk. So this X colon doesn't exist on my machine. Wait. So we'll get some error message from this backup statement, right? Now the problem if you want to catch errors is, typically in the cache block, what you want to do is you want to maybe roll back the transaction, log something, and then exit. And often when you exit, you want to actually rethrow the error, right, to the client side so it knows what's going on. And that was a pain in previous releases. Now you can just say throw. And we rethrow whatever messages we caught. So that's just simple but very, very useful. So the question is, can you use throw in a function? No, you cannot. Apologize. Sorry about this one. Yeah. So, yeah, we have some work to do with functions, clearly. But we have an item in the, you know, in this, what do they call them? Backlog, right? Throw in function. So another thing to notice about throw is it does not roll back your transaction, right? Why don't you roll back transactions, you may ask? Well, if you're handling your transactions all on the server side in the store procedure, it might be practical, right? If you throw, we roll back. The problem is it's also very common to have business logic on the client side. So on the client side, you may first issue a begin transaction statement, then you issue a bunch of statements, and then later you issue a commit or rollback. If we then would roll back when you used throw, the throw statement would not be as useful for you, right? Because you couldn't use it if you handle transactions from the client side. So that's why throw does not roll back transactions. But if we do honor the set transact abort on environment setting, right, or session setting. So if you set transact abort on, then we will roll back when you throw. So if you're doing all processing on the server side, it's a very practical setting. I like it a lot. Just set transact abort on beginning of the procedure, and then you know if an error occurs, we'll roll back. If you do throw, we'll roll back. So some comparisons. Raise roar, obviously, flexible. You know, I put it on the positive side. It's one of these APIs, you know, if you look at API design and you have like a function or something called fix it, right, then you know, this one can do many things. That seems scary. Well known, so that's obviously good. I'm very proud of this positive list here. But, you know, multiple behaviors, easy to get it wrong. And this is one of these things I would go and look at your code a little bit if you have a bunch of raise roar. It's very common to see something like, if something, right, raise roar, roll back, return. And that would not work so well if someone called this procedure from a try block, right? Because it would exit the procedure on the raise roar and not execute the rollback statement, right? So throw obviously would also exit, but it will always exit, right? So it's easy to know what's going on. So easy to use, similar behavior to other programming languages. We can rethrow, and you know it throws. That's what it does. XP log event. The nice thing with XP log event is we don't send a message to the client side, right? So it's raise roar with log will send to the client and write to the event log. XP log event just writes to the event log. So it's not supported in SQL Azure, Windows Azure SQL database, and there are no plans to add it there. And your own logging table, very flexible. You can define whatever attributes you want. On the downside, it's part of your transactions until we add autonomous transactions. So, calculations and aggregations. So, obviously here you could list a gazillion use cases. So, a typical one is I want to include aggregates in the details, right? So if I list transactions, for example, of a bank, I would like on each transaction to show what is the current balance of the account or something like this. What is the total number of transactions issued this day? And also, which is probably more common actually, is I want to do a calculation, but I want to reference other rows in my calculation, right, or other rows, rather than just other columns. So it's easy for me to do something like, you know, price times, you know, VAT percentage, and then you'll get whatever the VAT was. But what if I wanted to see, okay, what is the price difference between this product and the previous product in the product table, right? Then I have to use some sort of subquery. Options. So one is, if I want to do things like this, right, is imperative programming patterns, meaning a cursor or a loop, right? Correlated subqueries. And we also added now window functions, or we extended window function support in SQL Server 2012. So let's go through actually these slides first. So calculations across rows. Here, see the typical example for columns, right? Just you do the calculation with the columns. I don't know, we don't reference another column there. But for the other rows here, like what is the current bank account, bank balance, current account balance, number of days since the last transaction, amount of the previous transaction. Things like this can be extremely useful, right, to output. But with the current SQL capabilities of the previous release, I'd say it's iffy. So, as an example here, let's say I want to calculate the average amount of the last three transactions. What I really want to do is I want to define a partition, right? What is the data I'm querying over? And let's see if we can do this. So I'll create this transactions table. Transaction ID, account ID, transaction date, amount. And then we put a few values in there. So, and let's do order by tran ID. Okay, so that's my window. Now, always when you write a query, that is the full window that you're doing these calculations over. So if I had a where clause or group by, having, whatever is the output of this select, that is what I'm querying over. So this is not our fault. Like you guys all know that this select clause is misplaced, right? It's not supposed to be there. It's just the code guy or whoever tried, they thought, like, this sounds more like English, so it'll be very good. So it's supposed to be there, right? And then if I add where and so on, it makes more sense. Okay, so I have my query. And what I now want to do is, when I calculate the average of the last three transactions, the first one should get 120. Then 310, 350, and then the window should be sliding like this, right? And this is what is referred to as a frame. Okay. And you can see here, trying to write the code to do this is kind of non-trivial. You can run into lots of evil things with null values, for example, or, you know, it gets weird in these situations, right, when you're in the beginning of the window, end of window, and so on. So let's just see. So one thing you could do is you could declare a cursor, right? Create a cursor and then start walking through and doing your calculation as you go. This is a simpler one. This is just a running total. But you could do your three-day average like this, or a three-transaction average like this, and then return at the end, right? And you can imagine that this would be error-prone, right? So the other option is to use a correlated subquery. So this is also the, it's also not the, the average three transaction, it's the running total. But this query is interesting, right? I have my outer query that, that queries the transactions table. And then I have a subquery here where I say, hey, from the same table, right? It's a self-join, where transaction date is less than or equal to the current transactions date, that will give me the current balance of the bank in this case, right? And account ID if I wanted to get it for the account. Now this, unfortunately, is n squared complexity. So if you execute this, it will take a while to run. So if you have a reasonable size table, so for this small table, it should just run very quickly, right? But if you have a table with, let's say, a million rows, let's say it takes a year to run or something. It's insane, right? It will take a huge amount of time. And you could argue this is our fault, right? There are obviously more efficient ways to execute this. So the query optimizer doesn't recognize this pattern and does something about it. Pattern recognition overall in query optimization can be iffy. So you typically want to stay away from this. So that's why this window functions that we're going to look at is much clearer describing to the query optimizer what am I planning to do. And thus we can optimize it better or it's safer to optimize. You can also have multiple partitions. So the previous one was average over last three transactions across the bank, right? Let's say I, in this case, want to know what is the balance, the running total, the current balance of an account, right? So in this case, I want to create two partitions since I have two accounts here. And then I'll get one window frame per account, right? So this one now creates what is the balance of the account, and then for the second account, again creates the balance. And here you can imagine it's fairly clear that it's doing this n squared query is not the smartest thing, right? Since it's just a simple addition that you need to do. So let's take a look how we could write this using window functions instead. So what I want to do is a sum, right, of amount. And first, what happens if I just do this? Well, then we'll start complaining, saying, hey, woo-hoo, you're trying to do an aggregate and show details at the same time. This we don't understand. Please add a group by clause, right? But I don't want the group by clause. So already from 2005, I can say something like this, right? Over, and then I say, this is over the full window, right? So now I get, this is the current bank account or bank balance for the last transaction, right? What we can do in 2012 is interesting. We can say now over partition by account ID, because I want this per account, right? Order by transaction ID. Why do I care about the order? Well, for the running total to work, right? I have to execute it in a certain order. Now, this is not super intuitive. Let me just change the order by here so it's a bit easier. So order by account ID and transaction ID. So we see here for account 1, 120, 215, 465. This is a bit odd. Like, why did it filter? Right? The only thing I put in there was order by, right? And this is, by default, we do range between unbounded preceding and current row. And I'm not a big fan of these implicit clauses myself, but it's in the ANSI standard, so we try to follow the standard. So when I my previous query, it really had that. It just I didn't type it out. Okay. So now if I run this, we get the same result, right? But now it's very clear what it's doing. And what we support here is this is also something that we're working on, extending the support over over releases. You have both range and row, right? And you can't combine them. But what is the difference? Well, range is a logical comparison, right? And row is physical. So row will say, okay, start from x rows back or from the first row and go to the current row. Range will compare values, right? So range. Current row, let's say current row has an amount of 10. If the next row also has 10, range will include that row as well. Okay, so it's a logical comparison instead. In the range, we only support the well-known bounds. So we support unbounded preceding, unbounded following, go to the end, and we support current row. Those are the only range values we support right now. You can work around it. So row, we support also constants. So with row, instead of doing this range, I can obviously say something like row between two preceding and two following. So this will include a sliding window of five rows, right? And this is basically the difference between rows and range with regards to support, that we do support a number for rows to go back and forth. Range becomes very interesting when you have an interval data type. So currently we don't have an interval type. If you use .NET, for example, time span, so 5 hours, that can be very practical, right? Define a 5-hour moving average over something like a stock price. But row is powerful enough, I'd say, because if you use a subquery, if you have a previous query or a common table expression where you define, you make each row become a day, right? Or you make each row become an hour, you group by this, then you can use row to get to things like 5-hour average or 3-minute average or whatnot. So you can be extremely creative with this. And if you're working with data, I'd say this is these things that I'm going through here, this is the number one place where you want to spend some time with SQL Server 2012 familiarizing yourself. So how many of you have used the over clause with like row number function before? Okay, like half of you. So if you haven't looked at that, please look at row number. It was added in 2005. There are so many problems that you can solve so much easier set-based if you have a row number. Right, if you generate row numbers. And this is the same. There are so many problems with this functionality that you can solve a lot easier and with a lot better performance. But it takes some getting used to, right? So if you were spending some time sitting down and working with, it's always obviously best with your own data, right? The database that you're used to querying. Spend some time with this. There's an excellent book by Itzik Ben-Gan that is about this thick, which is good, right? I don't like these big ones. So this thick, that is all about window functions and advanced querying. So that's a really good book for insights into kind of leveraging SQL Server 2012. So so we support aggregations, these aggregation functions. We do not support user-defined CLR aggregates with window functions in 2012. That's something that we're planning also for our coming release. So if you created your own aggregate, you can still use it, right? But you can't use it together with rows and range. Analytical functions we added too. So we have the cumulative distance and the percent rank. Both of these are to calculate percentiles. So what is the 75th percentile best score or whatnot? And use these like use row number. Then we add the distribution functions, and this is very, very nice. Very nice. So we have the continuous percentile and the discrete percentile. And what is the 50th percentile? That's median, right? Ah, so we now have a median function. Very, very useful. So if I want to understand what is the median, let's say use the AdventureWorks database instead. So if we query the
products table. And I want to know what is the average price of my books, right? 438. So what if I would like to know what is the median price instead? Well, then you would use percentile.
So the continuous percentile. The difference between continuous and discrete is, I always mix these up, but one of them, so the problem is obviously if you have an uneven number of rows, or even number of, uneven, you just take the middle, right? But if it's an uneven, what do you do with the two guys, right? So I believe the continuous one, you basically calculate the average of these two rows. And the other one, you pick one of them, and I don't remember which.
0.5. And then I have to say within group, order by list price.
So whatever column I put here, that is what the function will return, right?
Now, unfortunately, this doesn't work in 2005. We don't have support for this as an aggregate. We only have it supported as an analytical function.
So you have to use it with the over clause.
And this is also something we're working on. So if I say over, and then obviously I have to have over here as well, right? And then, you know, I could do top one in this case. So now we see that the average is 438, but the median is 50. Right?
So extremely useful function. It's very common that you want to calculate the median. And obviously today, or with SQL Server 2008, you'll have to do it manually. Right? Get the rows, pick the middle, you know, using row number. And then you'll have to do this continuous versus discrete calculation yourselves. So this is a whole lot easier and also more performant. And then the best.
Oh, it's very nice.
Lag and lead. First value, last value. You can probably, you know, figure out what it means, right? Pick the first and last value. But lag and lead, you can offset, step around between rows. And this is where it gets very, very interesting. Like a common thing is you want to find holes in ranges, right? It becomes very easy if you can say lag, go back one row, okay? What was the value of, you know, ID one row back? And then if the difference is more than one, we have a hole, right? Very, very practical.
So let's use the same table again and pick list price.
And let's say I just want to see what is the price difference between the current product and the previous product. And obviously it doesn't make sense without an order.
So then let's just add that lag.
So which column we want to bring back, or which expression rather? This expression, just the column. And then you can also optionally specify how many steps back, right? So I want to go one back. That's also default. And you can also specify a default value. So what if the previous row doesn't exist? Well, then please give me something else back,
right? So I can say, please give me zero back. And then over, because I have to say, okay, what is the window we're operating over? So order by list price.
So remember, this order by has nothing to do with this order by, right? The only reason I have this is for presentation purposes.
Okay. And if we go down here a bit.
Here we can see, so current price is 229 and previous price was zero.
And obviously then I can go ahead and do calculations. So I could just do what is current price minus the previous price, right? as the difference. And now we can see here, so difference here is 187, 1, 261, and so on. And lead is obviously the opposite, right? Go forward instead of backwards. And this is a new world in the SQL language for sure. When you can do things like this, there are a whole bunch of calculations that is just don't lend themselves to SQL in a performant way, and you have to kind of do the calculation on the client side, which all of a sudden you can very easily do, and it's highly optimized. So do spend time on this. The over clause, the range and row, right, as well as lag and lead. Those are kind of keys to writing much more efficient queries and solving problems much, much easier. And it's a bit, there is a, yeah.
You can also use these where
Well, no, but you can put it in a common table. So the question is, what about using them in the where clause? So you can, but you'll have to first project this out of a common table expression or a subquery. So you select from something using this, and then you can use it in the where clause. Because given that the fact that this happens, you know, after this. So here is select, right? And this is where lag and lead happen. That's why you can't put them in the where clause, because where clause already happened. But if you compose your queries, then you can. So there is a downside to this as well, which is similar to row number function over clause for the guys who use that, is when you start using this, it will be very difficult to go back. Right? It will be very painful. It will be like you're in this little box. And you can... So it's very powerful, but you will like it a lot. Too much, maybe. Just the pros and cons again. Imperative approach. You know, the cursor thing is available in all languages. People are typically used to doing this. It's not set-based. We don't optimize this, or we optimize all queries individually. And it's I would argue that the high risk of bugs is a huge deal, right? The more lines of code you have, and handling the whole thing with beginning and end of the set as well as nulls, is very easy to produce the wrong results. Correlated subqueries, they make perfect sense, right? They follow its set-based paradigm, but performance is horrible when you do these kinds of correlated subqueries, because you get the n-squared complexity. Non-trivial to write, for sure more complex than the window functions, because then you just define, this is where I partition by, this is my order, please include, you know, rows, unbounded preceding, and current row, for example. Improved optimization, they're easier to write, as long as you spend some time with them. It's like always, there's a bit of a hump, but once you kind of get into the groove, it's really, really powerful. And it's definitely following the SQL set-based paradigm. It's part of the ANSI standard. On the con side, it's not always the optimal solution, right? So, like always, if you have a performance issue, there might be a reason to rewrite it to a cursor. It should be very, very few times, but there might be something you run into. And not all queries can be easily rewritten into window using window functions. But often they can. And especially if you do a subquery or a common table expression and use window functions on top of that, you can typically solve most problems. So, common tasks. So these are just some examples, very common things that probably all of us do. Transform data to and from strings. This is the thing that, you know, you don't want to do, but strings tend to be prevalent. Constructing dates, handling conversion errors, and paging. And options, you can write these yourself as user-defined functions. Some of them you can't write yourself.
So what we did in 2012 is just we added a bunch of very simple but very, very useful scalar functions. So the first new conversion functions. So we have convert and cast, you know, right? Try convert and try cast is just if the conversion fails, return null, right? Instead of throwing an exception. So let's see, I think I have a script with a few crap values we can use as an example, yeah. I'll talk about this in a bit. So we have this strings table, and it contains a bunch of stuff, right? Bunch of things that look like dates, a null, empty string probably, foobar, 1, 0. And now I want to find, let's say I want to find everything that is an integer, for example. Now, how would I do that before? Well, we have the isNumeric function, which is very iffy. But with tryConvert or tryCast, let's just try it first. We'll say, okay, give me this strdate column, and then tryCast strdate as int. And you can see that apparently empty string is a 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, and so on. And this obviously means that I could easily do this, right? It's not null. And now I grab only the ones that I can convert. Very simple thing, but extremely useful. And it's just the same cast function, so it's full fidelity with the type system. And so anything that works with cast will work with this. And try convert the same thing. the format function is also one of these things that is super, super useful. It's just I want to convert this number or date, right, into a string. And then we have this problem of formats, right? And .NET has excellent support for this with picture strings. So what we did is we just plug into the .NET framework underneath the covers and allow you to use the same functionality. So let's use the so here we have a bunch of dates, right? So now I can say, okay, format the order date column as what culture I want, I think it is. What format? So I want, let's say I want large, long date format is capital D. And then what culture I would want. So let's say I want this American culture. So now I get American date format there. If I go to the lowercase d, we can use this, and then we can try this, the Swedish format. So now you see here, the Americans don't have it right. This month, day, year, that and Fahrenheit, not good ideas. Cow body temperature. And then we have Swedish and also the ISO format, which is year, month, day. The other thing that I can also do here is I can keep the culture, but I can also use a picture string. So I'll say, okay, the Tobias format is year, T, MM, month, day. And now we have this Tobias format here. So whatever picture strings you can use in .NET, you can use them here as well. And very, very useful. Like typically, presentation you want to handle on the client side. But frequently, especially when you're past functionality, right, and you're into performance tuning, it can be very practical to be able to generate certain things on the server side. And then having a format function is really, really useful.
The other one is parse, which is the reverse. Okay, so we can get from something typed into a string. What about getting the other way from the string back into the type? And obviously parse versus try parse is analogous to try convert convert, right? It's try parse, if it fails, returns null. So now I can also try in this against this strings table. And we can do try parse. And we want to do what is the string value? Well, that's str date. And I want to convert this to a date type. And I want to use, since it looked like American date format, so I want to use American culture for this.
Why did it not return it as American culture? Well, that's because it's now a date type, right? So it formats it in whatever my machine is set to. And it's set to proper format.
And obviously now I can go in and say, okay, try parse this where this is not null, right?
The other thing you can do, which is very interesting, obviously you can use a case statement, right? So you can say, hey, case this, you know, when this thing is not null, do that, right?
When this other thing is not null, do, you know, Australian format. This other thing, go do Danish format.
Any Danes in here except, oh, a couple, yeah. You invaded Sweden. Not too happy about that.
Yes. So try parse, extremely useful, right? Especially in a case statement. Because typically things like this, this cleansing of data, right, when you do ETL processing, you have to do in things like SSIS and whatnot. If you can do it in SQL, it's very, very often a lot faster, right, and simpler. So dump it into a table, and then you can use try parse to cleanse the data. Very, very useful functionality. Also, it's very useful together with, you know, this open data source function. So you can, you know, select from open data source and then you specify a text file, for example, that you want to open. You query the text file and then you can use parse and try parse to cleanse the data in the text file and just pipe it into a table. So very, very useful. The other functions here, IIF, that's just what you have in Excel, right? So if this Boolean expression is true, return the first value, otherwise you return the second value. You can easily do this with a case. This is just, we're trying to add functionality in that lots of people are just used to using from other Microsoft products, so we want to make it available, right? Why force people to learn about new functions when it's Excel is like the number one database product, I'd argue, we sell, right? Everywhere. So if Excel has it, it's probably a decent idea to add. Choose is just an index into an array. And it's just a list, right? So if I say choose two, it will return the second value in the list. And the list is just a list of constants or expressions. It's not a query. And concat, same thing. It's just concatenate this list of values. It's not a group concat. It's not an aggregate, right? Across rows. It's within a row. But that one can actually be pretty practical. So we already had concat using plus, right? Well, now I could do this. Hey. And then concatenate with space, concatenate with null, concatenate with one. So since we know it's always a concatenation, right, we convert everything to a string. And as you can see, also, just like Excel, we ignore nulls in the concat function. So it can actually be very, very practical. You cannot do formatting. So if you want to do formatting, then you'll have to insert, you know, use format within concat. Compose the expression. New scalar functions. So first one we have EOMONTH, which is just returns the end of the month of whatever date you give. So if you give it, you know, the 25th of February, we return the 28th or 29th. In Sweden, we actually had the 30th of February once. No one else had that. It was the Swedish calendar. It's very, very cool. We were planning to move from Julian to Gregorian calendar in the 1700s, and then the king decided
we'll skip all leap days for 40, 50 years, and then we'll be in sync with the rest of the world. Whereas the British Empire planned to 1753, we will move. That's why the datetime data type in SQL starts at 1753. But then there was the Great Northern War, so we only remembered to skip once. And then and then the king in 1710 was like, ah! What to do? So he's like, okay, let's go back to Julian and you know, switch with the British guys. So that's why we had 30th of February to catch up again. And then you have these date, these from parts functions. It's just very practical, right? So select date from parts. It's very it's typical that you either want to just manually write in a date, right? Or that you want to calculate a date somehow from integers. So now I can just say it's 2012, you know, March 20. And this function will return that date. So very practical in queries. Right? It's like a constructor for a date type. And the same for all of the date types. Finally, we have offset and fetch, which is just a simpler way to do pagination within a result or across a result set. So let's just say we have this query, right? And now I want to page through it. Well, then we'll have to add an order by. So let's say order by sales, order ID. And now I can say offset, 10 rows. So skip the first 10 rows. Fetch next 10 rows only. Right? And then you can, next time you say offset 20 and so on. And obviously, here we support variables and expressions. And it's not, so there's no panic to go home and try, start switching over to this syntax if you use row number today for this. Performance is very similar. So this is not a performance improvement. It's just an ease of use syntactic sugar improvement. But it's very practical. And it follows, this is the ANSI standard way of doing this. We do support just doing offset, so you can skip the fetch, you can do only offset, but you can't do only fetch, then you still have to use, either you say offset zero, obviously, or you have to use top, and that's because of backwards compatibility, because we have the fetch next from a cursor statement as well, and we still don't force you guys to have semicolons at the end of statements. And if we want to do quick basically the parser can only look one token ahead, so we cannot know whether or not it's a cursor. And, yeah? Why the what? Oh, why the only? So we have this guy, Umachandra Jayachandran, that works for me, and he is our representative in the ANSI SQL standard. I would have to ask him. I think it's actually IBM's fault because I think they had some compatibility thing. They pushed this the standard in. So we're trying to be very picky to just follow the standard exactly. So even if you would think we don't need only, for example, but we don't want to make it optional and make it easier because we want to try to follow the standard. Exactly. But I think it's IBM's fault. Finally, we have this execute with result sets. And this functionality is a bit important. So we had a big change in SQL Server 2012, which is how you can deduce what would be the result set of a query were I to execute it. What did he mean? Tongue twister. So what we mean by this, so a good example is reporting services, right? You type in a query in reporting services, you hit refresh fields. How did it figure out which fields, you know, were being returned? Well, it asked SQL Server, if I were to execute this, what would you return? And we used to have a functionality called set FMT only before. And that was basically broken, so we replaced it with a new API. And the problem with this API is it's basically absolutely correct. And if you send a batch to the server, if you have a procedure that has, you know, if, else, blah, 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 right? And you ask the server, if I were to execute this, what would I get back? There can be lots of options, right? And then we would have to, if everything is not compatible, we would have to fail, right? Which we do. If you use this with result sets, you can say execute this procedure and force it to be this result set. Right? So it's like a contract on an execute call. And it works with dynamic SQL as well, for example. So dynamic SQL is a good example where we can't deduce what it would be because it's dynamically calculated. But then you can add the with result sets, and then reporting services, for example, would still be able to deduce the columns because you have manually set them there. So just briefly show, if I say execute select 1, hey, it's hello in Swedish. Now, if I try to deduce what this would be, SP describe first result set. Yeah. Now, this actually works because it's a constant. So then we say, ah, constant, then we can look at it. Let's just do this. Just say at SQL. Obviously, we would have no idea what this is, right? So we'll fail and say, hey, metadata for this XXSQL thing, I have no idea what that would be. But if we add with result sets, and I could say none, for example. Then I say guarantee there are no result sets, and then we'll fail if you try to return something. So this would fail, right? We say, okay, it returns ID as an integer, and it returns name as an mvarchar 10. That was exactly what was returned. And we convert everything into this data type, right? Or these data types. If I add this up here, now, obviously, we can deduce because you told us this is exactly what I will return. And so now it works. So now reporting services would work in this case, right? And obviously, if you lie to us and do three columns instead, we'll get upset and say, no, you said two. And we'll do explicit casts, as I mentioned. So if I send this as a string, I will still cast it to an integer. And you absolutely do not need to go and add this exec with result sets to all of your stored procedure calls. That makes absolutely no sense, right? It's only for dynamic SQL calls, really, where you want to specify the metadata, right? So it's really mostly a way to work around dynamic SQL calls not being able to deduce metadata. Okay. Thank you very much. I'll answer any simple questions that you have. Don't forget to fill out the evaluation forms, and thank you for coming.